better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.
Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life. If times get tough, or even if they don't, today is Thursday, July the 10th, 2025. And this is episode 3702 of the Survival Podcast. It is Thursday. That means it's time for the Expert Council Q&A Show of the Week. And we've got a good lineup for you today, including some folks you haven't heard from much for a while. Now, one person you hear almost every week is Dr. Ron Paul, and either Dan McAdams or Chris Rossini, or all three of them. This week, you do get to hear from Dr. Paul and Mr. McAdams, and their segment is called Two Competing Epstein Scandals. As you might imagine, I will have some dogpile on for that one. Matt Sersley will do a little bit of a spicy subject to demonstrate how asking how can I, when it comes to tax law, often can lead to an actual answer by using your mental computer. This is an exercise straight out of Laws of Life by me, myself, and I. Matt's going to say, can you write off a gun? You know, buy a new gun, can you write it off? Not always, but yeah, you can, maybe, possibly, but you have to ask how. That will give you an answer that will always be better than just saying, well, can I? How can I is the most important question you can ask for almost anything when it comes down to using the words can I. Without the how, it's pretty useless. Andy McCann will talk about how much life expectancy you can extend by focusing on lowering your blood pressure and your heart rate. Carrie Brown will talk about something called an oxymel as a way to preserve herbs. I had never heard of this. It is seldom, I do not know everything about herbs, but if it comes to the ways you can preserve and use herbs, I thought I pretty much had that down. I really did. I'd never heard of this one. It is sort of kind of like an extract in a way, but it's different and it's new, and you get to hear about it here first, for most of you anyway. Then Jesse Markowitz, who we haven't heard from much lately, is going to talk about a subject that I've been asked about, and I've really pretty much stayed out of it because it's not important to me, but I know it's important to some of y'all in the Bitcoin space, and that is Bitcoin Core versus Bitcoin Knots. And having someone like Jesse speak on this will prevent me from having to, though I might have a little addition after we hear what Jesse has to say. Chef Ken Daniels will talk about understanding the unappreciated, or should I say underappreciated, peppercorn. We all use salt and pepper all the time. Well, most of us do anyway. But have you really thought about peppercorns? The different options, where they come from, what they can do for you? I mean, you realize wars were fought over this stuff in the past, and today we just take it for granted. That means we're probably underutilizing something that's completely available today in many forms, and it has many uses. And then I'm going to talk about establishing a garden bed with spent mushroom spawn and composting with it in a little bit more. All these things we can do with mushroom spawn after it's done making mushrooms, whether it's you doing it or tying into someone who's running a commercial operation. Actually, the guy that sent this to me has a small mushroom farm near Philadelphia, and he's discarding 80 blocks of spawn a day. One small farm, 80 blocks a day. And because he's in that production mode, most of these farms, those blocks have a lot of viability left in them. They're pretty much one and done. In other words, once they get that first initial fruiting, it is more efficient for them to simply move that block out and shift the line than it is to try to get a second flush. When you're doing it at home like I do, you get a second flush, sometimes a third flush. I've got some blocks right now doing their fourth flush. But what I can tell you is the yield goes down and the time to the next flush goes down. So I get the commercial production. This guy is basically saying, I use this stuff, I give this stuff away. If somebody in this audience that's near Philly will come get them, I'll give some of them away. And he'll talk. I'm going to talk to you about what he said about how he's using these blocks on to establish garden beds and his additional further plans to eventually include them in bioreactor compost, which I think is a fantastic way. But I'm going to give a little bit of thought on when to involve it in the bioreactor compost. Well, let's say that maybe right from the beginning, but then maybe adding some more.
Yeah.
With that, let's go ahead and dive on off into it. But before we do, I want to remind you guys, you can always help support this show two main ways. One, become a member of the MSB. That's the Member Support Brigade. You know, the MSB is a great product. I don't charge myself for it, but I am a customer of it in that I use it. I use it all the time. I, too, use the discounts that I negotiate for you guys. That's why I negotiate so hard. That's why I got those guys on this week about the vehicle defense systems from F3 Defense Systems, right, with the pepper spray and all. I immediately got you guys a freaking massive discount. Now, you guys, everybody that listens to that, if you wanted to buy something right away, you didn't need to research it, 25% off for 2 weeks. But I got the MSB 30% off in perpetuity. That's a $500 product with 30% off. Am I going to use it on that purchase? I don't know. They're going to give me one, so I'll probably install that one first and decide if I want one for my other second vehicle. But, yeah, I would use it, and that would pay for your MSB for, like, 3 years. But just this morning, I decided to buy some more mushroom spawn to put in my boom room. I went over to Mushroom Mountain. I picked out, I think, like 5 or 6 blocks of spawn. I dropped in the discount code for MSB. I saved $25 and change on a $50 product. I got half of the value of an MSB of a paying customer in one order just for mushroom spawn. And it wasn't like I ordered a case of it or something. I ordered 6 blocks. That's pretty badass. And they shipped it for free, too. That's even better. And, I mean, I use my MSB all the time. I really encourage you to start thinking about supporting this show through MSB if you're not and never have, or if you have and let it expire. If you'll use the discounts, even just a few times a year, if you'll make a focused effort to make sure, hey, always check, make sure. You're going to put money in your pocket. I always say, you know, if you hate me, you should probably be a customer anyway, unless you hate money more than you hate me. Because if you're not an MSB member and you're buying the kind of things we talk about on this show, you probably hate money. Because you could be putting money back in your pocket with it. The other way is doing your online shopping at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. I got an item of the day. It really hadn't sold much. And I think part of it is I haven't really made a focused effort on the show to sell it to you guys yet. And the one time I really did mention it was at the end of a very long episode. And people kind of tune out at the end of those really long episodes. Anyway, you guys know that my background is in telecommunications. At least you guys have been around a long time know that. I came up, you know, like doing central office installation work for MCI. These are like the long-distance phone terminals that routed all the calls all over the country and then went into data cabling and computer hardware and computer testing equipment and all. And eventually I moved into sales with all of that. And I had as a very early customer Mark Cuban back when Broadcast.com was still Broadcast.com, not bought out by Yahoo. And one of my contacts at Broadcast was a gentleman named Patrick Seaman. I don't want to go deep into it. I'm just going to tell you this man is a good man. He is the salt of the earth. He became incredibly wealthy when Broadcast was sold to Yahoo. And he did a lot of entrepreneurial things, but I'm not going to get into it, but a lot of very philanthropic things as well. This is the kind of guy that you want to be wealthy because he does the right thing. And over the years, I've not stayed in close contact, but every time I've reached out to him, he's always treated me like a friend. And there is no reason for a man to feel a need to do that when the last time that we met face-to-face would have been about the year 2000. It's 25 years. And if I pop him an email, it's right back and he remembers who I am. That's the kind of guy this man is, just to set the stage here. He recently released a book called Streaming Wars. And I was mentioning him. I'm writing Laws of Life 2 right now. And I was mentioning some interactions with him in my book. And I just wanted to make sure I had everything accurate as to the timeline and what actually happened when I said it happened in the book. It was important to me naming someone by name like this that I wasn't inaccurate. So I looked him up. And I found out he was releasing this book. Guys, you want to read this book. I know it doesn't sound like really exciting reading, but it's so interesting. Now, to me, I understand why I have some nostalgia for it. I was directly involved with it. I designed multiple data centers for Broadcast, including the final one that was kind of the icing on the cake that helped them execute the deal with Yahoo. So there's some nostalgia there for me. But if you are my age, a little bit younger, a little bit older, and you came up through the 90s and watched technology evolve, if you did all that, if you remember the days of dial-up and clicking on an image and watching it slowly load a single image, what you probably don't know is the first company in the world to stream anything on the internet was Broadcast.com. Broadcast.com was not a scam company. Mark Cuban did not successfully sell a domain name for $5 billion, which some people seem to think happened. In some ways, I consider Yahoo, like Kodak, only worse because they were much closer to the time frame to really develop it. Do you know in the 1970s, Kodak developed the very first digital camera? And they decided not to do anything with it because it would be bad for their film business. So they buried it, and of course, we all know what happened. Digital cameras really started to show up heavily from many manufacturers in the 90s. And today, almost nobody uses film, and Kodak is a shell of what it could have been. Kodak could have had a 25-year head start in the digital camera market. They could have had numerous patents. So even all your camera phones and all, they would be earning royalties off until today. They had the proprietary technology and a 20-year road to develop it, and they didn't do it. How's that apply to Yahoo and Broadcast? When Yahoo bought Broadcast.com, I'm going to tell you, Broadcast was one of the only companies on the internet in the late 90s during that dot-com boom that had a real product, real customers, and real revenue. Every time I walked into that facility to meet with one of my contacts, what I noticed instantly was a couple dozen reps with headsets and cubicles on the phone talking to radio stations and sporting event operators, content libraries, teams, radio stations, you name it, about getting online. And with 56K dial-up internet being the standard, they were able to stream audio, which was amazing. That's why the whole thing started out being called AudioNet. But they were able to stream video, point to multipoint, on dial-up. Was it perfect? No, but they made it work. They made it work. Do you know that Broadcast.com streamed the first ever streamed Super Bowl? Point to multipoint, 500,000 people, mostly on dial-up, watched the Super Bowl. That's why they were able to sell what they had for so much money. When that company went to Yahoo, Yahoo literally screwed the pooch. They blew it. They blew it. They effed it up in every way. They turned it into basically a competitor to YouTube, but YouTube didn't exist yet, as Yahoo Video. They let all of the contracts with the radio stations, the content libraries, the sports teams, all of it fall flat on its ass and expire and become open to competition. They had it all locked up. And they eventually just quit. They didn't do anything with it. They paid $5 billion for something and then basically threw it in the garbage. They didn't listen to anybody that stayed on with Broadcast after the acquisition. And they did put more money into what was already working, but then they didn't use it. And then what happened? YouTube happened. Twitch happened. Netflix happened. And the whole world runs on streaming video and audio today. Audible. Broadcast had the Audible model before anybody heard the word Audible. They did. Broadcast had thousands of books available to stream. They had a subscription model. They had it all. Patrick's book goes through how they built that, not just technologically, but the business side, how they pitched it to investors, how they built a company from literally nothing. In this book, he literally tells a story about breaking into Mark Cuban's house to reboot servers in the middle of the night and having to do it multiple times because Mark wasn't there. That's how shoestring this was. When this started, there were three people in it. Patrick was one of them. And then Patrick became the first official employee and built this company from nothing, from a $10,000 investment by Mark Cuban and to a $5 billion entity, only to have it flushed down the toilet by the people that bought it. And if you want a history of internet technology and how this all played in together, this is a great book to read. I'll put it to you this way. Do you like watching those things that are like 80s, the decade that made us, and they show like 10 episodes, and they show you all the things, and you remember like, oh, I was there, I remember when that happened. If you like that, you'll like this. Now, if you're 25, 30 years old, and you were like 5 years old or younger when this was all going on, you won't have that nostalgia, but you'll have a new appreciation for what you take for granted. And you'll get an incredible lesson in technology and business. So this is not a prepper item. But inside this community, there are people that love technology, they love business. And all of you are using streaming technology. You're streaming audio right now. Right now. There were no podcasts in 1995. Except that there were. They just didn't use RSS yet. This is a fascinating read, authored by a really great guy. And I really think you'll enjoy it if you give it a shot. Again, it's called The Streaming Wars. And it doesn't just cover the broadcast years. It goes up all the way up to now. And how all these companies came together and competed in this space. And what could have been and what is. Really, really interesting. At least I think so. Give it a shot. Make it your next read. Streaming Wars by Patrick Seaman. With that, let's go ahead and drop into it. That was a long intro, but I'm telling you I enjoyed the shit out of this book. I'm probably going to read it again. Ironically, the one form you can't get it in is the audio. I'm going to reach out to Patrick and see if he's using KDP to publish, because if he is, I'm going to let him know. You can tick a button, bro, and all of a sudden, it will be an audiobook within a couple days. All right, with that, let's go ahead and hear from Dr. Paul and Dan McAdams on the two competing Epstein scandals.
We want to talk about, what's going on, because everybody else is talking about it, and we're trying to sort it out ourselves. And that's the Epstein scandal.
Yeah.
And it's sickening when you read about it. And, you know, they talk about, there's been reportings, I happen not to accept them at face value, 1,000 people have been on, you know, participants in this scandal. And everybody knows how horrible it is, but when the Republicans get in, they're going to clean it up. Well, it looks like in the last 2 days they tried to close it down, and they've elected one person and put her in jail. She was a ringleader, but nobody else has been indicted. And the announcement this week was, yes, there's nothing to it. It's there's not a real problem here. You know what that does to me? I wonder what really is there. And that's what we want to talk about today.
Because I think what we're talking about, the Epstein issue, is two competing scandals. One that's above the surface like an iceberg, and one that's below the surface. Now, the one above the surface is child abuse. It's salacious. It captures people's attention. You mean a powerful person was abusing children, and other people would go to his abode to also do such nefarious activity. And that gets everyone excited because it's so horrific. But on the other side, it's the influence operation part that people aren't talking about as much. Why was this happening? Was it because the guy was just a sicko, or was there something else? And now the narrative that I think the administration is trying to push, and a lot of people connected to it, is option A. It's all about the perversion and the sicko. And now if you go to the next one, this you can see in Pam Bondi, the attorney general, she's actually pushing that narrative. Here's what she responded when Trump, in the same press conference, she said, first, to back up on that, in February I did an interview on Fox, and it's getting a lot of attention because I was asked a question about the client list. And my response is, it's sitting on my desk to be reviewed, meaning the file along with JFK and MLK files as well. That's what I meant by it. Also, to the tens of thousands of videos, they turned out to be child abuse. I'll use a different word because of the voice recognition. Child abuse downloads that by that disgusting Epstein. Child abuse is what they were. Never going to be released. Never going to see the light of day. So she's basically saying, if you're interested in this info, then somehow it's a child abuse aspect. You're just interested in the salacious. But let's return to that original one that the journalist that I mentioned, and this was on, this was featured on Zero Hedge. You might want to grab your earpiece.
I've been at this for 21 years, and Epstein had cameras in all of his homes. I mean, Epstein was definitely a blackmail artist. And the government wants to make sure that that is not, does not come out, that a huge part of our political system is predicated on blackmail. And especially if that dark, malignant corner of the intelligence that is using blackmail against our politicians and other people, if they were using children, I mean, that would make the American people erupt. So that's why that Wikipedia page is locked down. And that's why this is important. This is, for that corner of intelligence. This is Omaha Beach. You know, they're not going to give an inch.
Well, what Nick Bryant, the journalist interviewed here, what he was saying is something, if true, would rock the country to the core. And that's why he's saying that everyone is pushing the child abuse narrative rather than the idea that our entire government is corrupted. It's all being blackmailed. Now, we don't know by who. Could it be the Israelis? Could it be the CIA, the deep state? Who could it be? But the idea that every senator or every senator of consequence, every member of Congress of consequence, every top political and maybe religious figure of consequence are being actively blackmailed. A few years ago, I would say it's the craziest conspiracy theory I've ever heard. But the more we hear about it and the more also we notice the cover-up, the more possibility it seems, and it would rock the country to the core.
So don't see anything that I'm about to say as defending Bondi, Patel, Bongino, Trump, Vance, anybody in this administration that's letting this shit happen, because I'm telling you straight out of the gate, it isn't. But I'm going to say some things that I think are important to evaluate in the entirety of the situation, and it may actually make things worse, not better. So, first of all, on February 26th, on X, I made a meme and I posted it, and it's a picture of the kid with the bending spoon from The Matrix. Remember? You must realize there is no spoon, only you, right? That kid, remember that? You cannot bend the spoon, it's impossible, it is you that bends, right? That kid, that picture, with Neo in the reflection of the spoon, and this is what it says on the meme. The truth about the client list? There are clients, but there is no list. I posted on February 26th. And then this is word for word what I said along with the post. Sorry, this is reality. There will never be a release of the, quote, list, end quote, because there is no list. There are clients. We know who they are, but there is not and never was a, quote, list, unquote, to release. Now, what some people took that to mean is that there's no list anywhere. That's not what I said. I'm telling you that we tried to make it like this was all being hidden by the Southern District of New York FBI office, and that's the stuff that eventually ended up on Bondi's desk. Okay? It was never there. I don't believe it was at Jeffrey Epstein's New York apartment. I don't believe that Jeffrey Epstein was the blackmailer. I believe, and this is all opinion, okay, understand this, and it does not mitigate a damn thing these people did, or the complicit cover-up our government is involved with it at all. I believe Jeffrey Epstein was an agent of blackmail, meaning that he was being operated by a third party. And that third party, I do not believe, was the United States government. I believe that third party was, in fact, Mossad. I know that'll really bother some people to hear me say that, but it has all the hallmarks of a Mossad operation. And there's a lot of, if you go back in time and you look at all of the ties back to Epstein and all the things that happened with him, it has all the hallmarks of a Mossad operation. I dare say more so than a CIA operation. Not that our CIA wouldn't do it. It just doesn't look like one. It doesn't smell like one to me. And part of why I believe all this is no one anywhere can tell me or anybody else how the F Jeffrey Epstein got all the money he had. And the conventional wisdom is, well, dummy, he got it by trafficking children. And I think we do need to be accurate. Children is the right word, but it conjures up images of perverted dudes with five-year-old little boys or something like that. These were teenage girls. I have not seen any evidence that it was anything other than teenage girls. Now, I think all of the people involved should, like, find their way into a wood chipper for this, but let's be accurate about it. Okay, so it's not a mitigation. It's just a desire for accuracy. Now, what does this all have to do with the files or the list or whatever that was at the New York office of the FBI? I bet you it's very possible that the tapes that were seized from his apartment had what the gentleman here referred to as child abuse on them. And what they were trying to avoid saying, and I'm going to avoid saying it too. I'm not worried about it in the podcast feed. I'm worried about the video version of this show that 'll go on YouTube. Because I do that now with my Thursday shows. I make one little, you know, like thumbnail that just stays the whole time, and I put it on there for people that want to listen to it on YouTube. But the word rhymes with corn and starts with a P. Child that, okay? That's what they were saying if you didn't get it, if you need someone to translate it for you. So I'm going to just tell you that, you know, I just did a whole segment about broadcast.com. So transmitting video signal isn't really hard to do in the modern age and hadn't been while he was running his shit. The level of sophistication that there was technologically in his apartment and in some of his other properties would indicate that the people that installed it kind of knew what they were doing. You'd think that when a guy's a billionaire, and a billionaire who we can't identify his source of income. Right? This is done so sophisticated that it has the hallmarks that you got to be like, if you're U.S., you got to be like NSA or CIA. If you're a foreign intelligence organization that would do it, you're looking at China or Israel. I'm just saying, those are your four suspects. And to me, the most likely one is Mossad. And it might explain why we continuously do so much stupid shit. And I just want to ask you if you've noticed this. If you've noticed this at all. During COVID, there were like magic words if you were on the left that you had to say. Remember the magic words? You know, keep your distance and all that. But here's the real magic words. The one that came off like you would expect to be recited by a hostage put in front of a camera with a gun in their back you can't see. I have been treated well. Like that? Remember it? It was whenever any of these prominent people who had gone out publicly and stated they had received the vaccine and now they were going to be protected, then got COVID. I am at home resting comfortably. My symptoms are mild. I am grateful for the protection the vaccine continues to provide. I believe that I'm like 99% accurate on that quote. It was something that scripted, and they all said it the same way. They all had their handlers posted on Twitter for them, etc. Remember that? Okay, you know what sounds just like that to me? When any of our politicians are speaking, and anything remotely like brushes up against Israel. Israel is our strongest and greatest ally. It's the same preaching of the same bullshit. I'm not the guy that's going to jump all over Israel, over everything. I've pointed out before that I think Dan McAdams has a very hard time staying completely logical and rational. The second Israel's involved with something, the anger turns on, the fire turns on, and he kind of goes over the top. So I'm not that guy. But I'm going to tell you, if there is a darker intelligence agency than Mossad, I don't know what it is. And this smells like it, looks like it, and sounds like it in every way. And I think that my meme will forever be a prophecy fulfilled. The truth about the client list. There are clients, but there's no list. None that you shall ever see anyway. And I think, no matter how much you like Trump, even he knows the battles he cannot win. You have to ask yourself, does this go back even further? Even if he's not on the list, right? He's in the files. Well, so is everybody that was interviewed. He was a known associate of Epstein. Every associate of Epstein was interviewed. He's in the files. If somebody went and unalived my neighbor right now, I'd be in the files because the police would come ask me what I knew, and then I'd be in the files. So even if he had nothing to do with it, there's still leverage points. There's still, sir, do you understand what could happen here? Because I have to ask you this. Go all the way back to 2016, 2017. Ask yourself how this happened. Lock her up. Lock her up. Lock her up. 5 minutes into the next day, when asked about it, I don't want to hurt them. They're good people. How did that happen? And does that have anything to do with this? I don't know, but all of it stinks to high heaven to me. Let's go on to some other more productive things today. Let's now get to talk to Matt Sersley about, of all things, can you tax deduct the purchase of a gun?
Hey, TSP crew. This is Matthew Sersley of AgristTaxAdvice.com, here to talk to you about how to save more money on your taxes. Other than setting up your business properly, the most important part of saving taxes in a business is maximizing your business expenses. Now, You need to stop asking, is this deductible? Remember, Jack Spirico tells us your brain is a computer. So ask it, how do I make this deductible? Now, sometimes the answer is it's not, but it's still a much better question to ask because maybe you'll figure something else. So just to illustrate this point, we're going to explore a bit of a spicy example. Can a business buy a firearm and deduct it? Well, first remember the most basic part of what makes something deductible. The expense has to be ordinary, something that's common in your type of business. And it must be necessary, something that's helpful and appropriate for your business operations. That doesn't mean it has to be absolutely essential. It's just something a reasonable person in your business might use. Well, there's some incredibly easy cases where the IRS has said this is allowed. So if you are required to carry a gun as part of your job and have to buy the gun yourself for your business, then you can expense the gun. This applies to private security. This can apply to high-value couriers. It applies to bodyguards, etc. If you're in the business of buying, selling, even repairing guns, I think it's a pretty easy thing to justify buying another gun as a demonstration model, that sort of a thing. And finally, if you're a farmer or a rancher and there is any sort of a legitimate predator threat, a firearm is absolutely a legitimate security tool and a business asset or even a necessity. It's very easy to justify and very easy to document. Don't think you're going to have any problem as long as you stay reasonable. You know, if you buy that $20,000 AR-15 to protect your 10 chickens from the coyote, that's probably not ordinary. But as long as you're reasonable, should fly just fine. Now, a bit more of a gray area, but I think very easy to justify with the right documentation. If you are a real estate agent who has to travel around, particularly to any sort of bad part of town or even, you know, not great part of town, if you're somebody who has to travel around, particularly at night or in rough parts of town, if you own a retail shop in an area where there is crime that happens on a more than, you know, once in a blue moon sort of scenario, or if you're anybody who deals in a very large amount of cash or valuable goods, you know, the stereotypical diamond dealer probably has a pretty good justification both on the value of the retail shop, but also if they got to carry around those diamonds, well, they got to be able to protect it. You know, there's a very strong argument here that the personal safety and property protection is tied directly to your business duties. I don't think it's a stretch, but again, you're going to want to have written documentation of this, policies and risk assessments, and you're going to need to be careful what you buy. You know, that quintessential diamond dealer, a Glock, probably fine. A 1911, probably fine. A shotgun, maybe for protection in the building, but not for carrying around. But again, some sort of an AR-15 or a sniper rifle, I think you're probably crossing the line, especially if you're doing something more than an off-the-shelf model. Now, the harder cases, business with no obvious security risk, and particularly if you have no customer contact. So if you are an online consultant buying a rifle just in case, that is not going to fly. But if you have valuable assets in your home for the business, such as, you know, your customer data in a profitable business, there's a valid argument to this. Is it going to work? I don't know. I want to be very clear. I'm not aware of any IRS cases or court precedent specifically talking about that sort of a case either way. But I look at the rules. Is it necessary to have some sort of security to protect your business assets? Yes. Is it ordinary to buy some sort of a gun to protect your business assets? Here, again, in this kind of third harder case, the value of the business, the value of the assets, the amount of money spent on the gun is going to really matter a lot. Again, something like a simple shotgun or a handgun or maybe even an off-the-shelf AR-15, totally fine. You're going to have a hard time justifying a sniper rifle, obviously. Document all of this stuff. If you want to go for it, go for it. But this is an area where pigs get fat and hogs get slaughtered. I would not try to buy a gun every single year in this sort of a business. I might buy a new gun every 4 to 5 years in this sort of a business. Whereas in that first case, you know, you're in private security. I mean, you could probably justify buying 4, 5, 6, 7 guns a year if you actually use them for your work, right? Now, once you buy the gun, you can also start buying some of the other stuff regarding it. So, especially in those first two cases, training and using the gun, rifle or range time, ammunition for training purposes only, that's the type of thing you can probably write off as well. Now, in that super easy case, I think going, you know, to the range 3, 4, 5 times a year, probably justifiable. Taking a class at Gunsight or something, I don't think they're even around anymore, but their equivalent, you know, very justifiable. The in-between case, you know, yeah, go to the range 3, 4 times a year, maybe pay for a course every other year, every 3 years. That hard case, I still think going to the range once, twice a year is a totally acceptable thing, but I probably wouldn't go for the training class. I definitely wouldn't do it more than once per employee. You know, maybe one time when someone first comes on, they have a gun, they need the safety training, but after that, you don't pay for it. You know, be reasonable. You know, again, this case is mostly hypothetical. This is something I have some clients who do and I have some clients who don't. And we have a long discussion about the risks and benefits of this. But again, it's more of a thought experiment. How far can we push this basic framework to make something deductible? I think you can see it is way more flexible than you might think. Well, if you want some other ideas for things like this, go to agristaxadvice.com/TSP. I've got a free download there with only over 60 different business deductions people miss, things like firearms. This kind of strategic thinking, asking how something can be deductible, is exactly what opens up the opportunities. It's how I came up with that list in the first place. Well, many items on the list. Thanks so much.
The big takeaway from that segment is not just that in many instances you can in fact deduct the purchase of a firearm or even maybe a couple of them from your taxes. It's to always ask the question, not can I, but how can I? It is amazing what happens with that, including when you're asking professionals who should do it themselves. If you go to your CPA and say, can I deduct a gun from my income tax? They may very well say no. If you simply ask that person, how can I? That actually may change the way they look at the question. That's why I'm so big on always asking the question that way. How can I have? How can I do the following? How can I obtain the following thing? It is amazing what happens when the brain is challenged. One of the biggest problems we have in the world today is we do not challenge our brains enough, and we have actually been conditioned to dumb things down by challenging our brains less. I mean, we're literally being conditioned to do that on a daily basis by the government, by the school system, you name it. Moving on, let's go ahead and hear from Andy McCann on the effects of blood pressure and heart rate on life expectancy.
Hello and good morning. This is Andy McCann coming to you from Woodstock, Georgia, where I own CrossFit Garage. I also do a podcast called Food, Fitness, and Finances, so we go over those things. The question I got, so I was up at the festival that Nicole just put on called the Spring Workshop, and it was up at her in her holler. It was awesome. It was great to meet everybody. I'm going to go back on this kick real quick. If you guys aren't connecting, you're missing out. Show up to some of this stuff. Jack does some things in person. Nicole does things in person. There's other stuff happening in person. Show up. Be part of the group. That's going to help you tremendously, not only in your just love of what we're doing, but in the connection and your longevity. Okay, so the question that came up, we talked a lot about this, was blood pressure, heart rate, and all sorts of stuff, because you know I'm that guy. And so it was about, how much can you really affect your life expectancy just by attacking your blood pressure and your heart rate? And the answer is actually quite a lot. So I've got this ChatGPT thing going, this prompt that I've built up, and I asked it, I was like, hey, here is my details. Build out a life expectancy and a functional life expectancy. I put in the wrong blood pressure and heart rate. I just went and gave blood, and they did my biometrics. So I came back and put it back in when I got home and said, hey, this is the real stuff. How does it adjust? So just for me, as an example, using the tables that chat can pull off of the internet, I originally put in 110 over 70 as my blood pressure, and then I came back and put it in as 103 over 65. I just gave blood, they monitored me, and that's what it was. So my life expectancy went from a high of 92 years to 94 years. So 2 years for affecting my blood pressure by 10 points, not even that really. It was only 7 and 5 points on each side. But the better thing was the functional life expectancy went from 82 as the high to 87 as the high. And that's crazy. But when you do the background research, you're going to find out that, especially for men, as we become 50 and older, we enter the drop-dead years. And the things that take us out, it moves from accidents and suicide to strokes and heart attacks. So basically the idea that I'm working with these days is, how do you actually clean your blood? But you can see it here in this chart. Well, you can't see it. I'm looking at it. That if you can affect your blood pressure in all the ways you can, then you can reduce your chances of death in these things according to the charts. So you might be thinking to yourself, well, then how do I actually reduce my blood pressure? Well, there are a lot of ways. Obviously, it's going to be a big part about how you eat and then how you view the world. So, I mean, we've talked about this before. Cut out sugars, cut out refined foods. You have to do that. This came up as well at the workshop. Hey, Andy, do you do one-on-one training? And the answer is yes. If you want to hire me, I am $1,000 an hour. Or you can track your food for 2 weeks, and I'll help you for free. So there's two reasons I say that. One is if you track your food for 2 weeks, you're going to see the big things that you need to do. And most people don't want to put the time in to do it. If you're not going to put the time in to even track your food for 2 weeks, then you're not going to listen to me, and I don't want to work with you. Okay, another way is to reduce your processed food and seed oils. You can eat potassium-rich food, get enough magnesium, this is a weird one. It says limit your salt, but I don't know if that's actually true because I'm eating a ton of salt, and my blood pressure is crazy low. And then, of course, work on hydration. I think that's going to say also fix your electrolytes. Another big part, and this is a no-brainer, movement and fitness, do something. I told you before, after doing CrossFit for 20 years, I think the secret to the success is if you're going to work out all week, which you should, 5 days a week, then you want to squat below parallel 3 days a week, get out of breath 3 days a week, and lift something heavy 3 days a week. If you mix that up in any combination you want, you're going to do pretty well for yourself. And then the part that most people don't really want to do, but you should, which is manage your stress. Practice deep breathing, maybe some cold exposure or some sauna exposure. I like the idea of heat more than cold. Get 8 hours or more of sleep, whatever you need. Your body, everybody's body is a little bit different. And get some sunlight exposure in the morning. Actually, the sun is coming up right now. I'm going to refill my coffee and get some sunlight, and I'll come back to you guys in a second. I love technology. That was a tiny little blip for you and a long blip for me. Anyway, other things you can do is donate blood, which I'm working on right now, and lose that excess fat. Of course, that kind of comes into eating and moving. Avoid or limit your alcohol. And if you're thinking to yourself, hey, I don't like these suggestions, you can go into chat and say, give me 100 ways to lower my blood pressure. It will give you 100 ways. It's awesome. The last thing I'm going to leave you with is a link to this. It's a blood pressure and a heart rate monitor that then can link up to your phone, because why wouldn't it link to your phone? Track yourself. This guy right here has got 42,000 reviews and is a 4.4 stars. It's pretty awesome. It does what it's supposed to do, and I love that. I'm going to provide the link here. It's through Amazon. Of course, click on Jack's T-Spaz link before you order it. This guy will help you see what you're doing. And I think the bigger part of it is when are you stressed out, right? When I'm laying down and just about to get out of bed, if I put it on and monitor myself, that's going to tell you what you were doing all night long. Of course, you can get one of those other Fitbits or things you can do all night long. You can get one of those to track yourself. But this is going to hit your blood pressure. You can also do it after you talk to your boss, after you go for a walk. So you can get an idea of what things, like breathing, are actually affecting your blood pressure. Fix your blood. Fix your life. It's definitely going to help. All right, guys. Again, this is Andy McCann. You can reach me at andy@crossfitgarage.com, and I'm happy to help you out. Y'all take care.
The only thing I want to add add on to what Andy had to say, because it's all great, is the salt thing. This shit that salt causes high blood pressure is bullshit. And it's always been bullshit, and it will always be bullshit. Now, I'm not going to say that there is no person whose specific situation might not have salt being an aggravating circumstance to high blood pressure. People with massive fluid retention and things like that, sure. But overall, as a general concept, no, salt doesn't cause high blood pressure. It's another lie. It is yet another lie. You can't show me anything that conclusively proves it in the absence of other factors. And humans naturally intake salt, and we naturally limit our intake of salt. I've seen people use more salt than I would, but I've never seen anybody like put salt on their food by the tablespoon. So it's just another one of those bullshit things from modern medicine. Let's move on and let's hear about a way to preserve herbs that I've never heard of before from Kerry Brown.
Hey, TSP community. Kerry here from Strong Roots Resources. And in lieu of telling you guys about a plant today, I'm going to tell you a little bit about a form of preservation and use for whatever you're foraging, or at least certain things that you're foraging, that's a little different, and it was kind of new to me as of a few weeks ago. So we know we can always create tinctures, teas, various kinds of extracts. We can dry things. We can freeze dry. We can preserve our finds, you know, whether it's our gardens or whether we're out wildcrafting, all kinds of ways. But there is another way that I've recently found out about, and it is called an oxymel. That's O-X-Y-M-E-L. This is an herbal preparation that is made from primarily two base ingredients. Raw vinegar, preferably real apple cider vinegar. So we're talking about this stuff that still has the mother in it, not the fake stuff at the big box store. So make sure you have real apple cider vinegar and raw honey. And then you blend in whatever specimen that you are working with. So, and this can be herbs, it can be roots, it can be spices, it can be fruit. If you need to avoid alcohol for whatever reason, and I'm one of those people who does not keep alcohol in my home whatsoever, so I don't do tinctures. It's not a thing. I have to keep that stuff out of the house. An oxymel can be used kind of in place of tinctures. It's not exactly as powerful, and you're probably going to use more of an oxymel in terms of how much you consume versus, you know, a few drops of a tincture. But you can certainly use these to make a somewhat shelf-stable preparation. So oxymels preserve the medicinal properties of the herbs. It can extract both water-soluble and alcohol-insoluble constituents. It's a great alternative, like I said, for avoiding alcohol, and it's really tasty and really easy to use, especially if you're trying to make this herbal preparation for children or somebody with a picky palate. And because we're working with living creatures in the form of the honey and the alcohol, it's very supportive of your immune, digestive, and respiratory health, depending upon what kind of herbs are going into that preparation. So the kind of most basic ratio folk method, if you just want to get started on this, one part honey, one part vinegar. You add a handful or so, depending on the amount you're working with, of fresh or dried herbs. You steep it for 1 to 4 weeks. Probably a mason jar would be the best option for this. And you bottle it. You can always adjust that honey to ratio vinegar for taste, whether you want to go a little sweeter or a little more tart. You can absolutely play around with that. In terms of using an oxymel, you can do it as like a daily tonic. So that would be anywhere from a tablespoon or a teaspoon straight right down the chute, or you can add it to your water and tea. You can do it as a salad dressing or a marinade. You can do it in mocktails, which is something I really like to play with, especially if you've got some soda water. And you can also take it like you would take a cough medicine for coughs, sore throats, by the spoonful placed into some warm water. Let me give you some common oxymel combinations here to kind of get you started. For immune support and colds, thyme, ginger, garlic. For cold and flu prevention, elderberries, cinnamon, and clove. For a liver support and detox, dandelion leaf and dandelion root. To help calm your nervous system and manage stress, we've got lemon balm and lavender. And for cognitive support and respiratory support, rosemary and sage. So really, the list is pretty endless. This is the fun part about it. You know, raw honey can be a little bit expensive, but most of us can still get a hold of it. Good quality vinegar, good to have on hand anyhow, because it can help you address so many issues. Those things are very shelf stable, so it's easy to store them into your preps. Let me go a little bit deeper on how to kind of make an Oxymel step by step. So you choose your herbs, fresh or dried. If you're going to use fresh ones, chop them real finely so you get more surface area available for the infusion. Fill a clean jar about a half to three quarters with the herbs. Pour in equal parts honey and apple cider vinegar until everything is covered. Stir well or shake daily and then cap it. Use a plastic lid or line a metal one with wax paper because that vinegar will corrode our metal ball lids. Let it steep for 2 to 4 weeks in a cool, dark place. If you are off-grid like me and you have a lot of variable temperatures, depending upon what part of the place they are, like I like to do mine in the back of the fridge, just because, you know, when we get hot, we can get real hot. After that 2 to 4 week period, strain through cheesecloth or through, you know, some kind of strainer into a clean bottle, label it, and store it in the fridge, and it'll keep for 6 to 12 months. So, like I said, the options here are pretty endless. I have made, the first Oxymel that I made was with the self-heal herb, which is in the mint family, grows all along various kind of sunny slash shaded edges on our farm, and I kind of use that as an all-purpose tonic if I am feeling like I might be coming down with something, or I'm just kind of not feeling my best, or if I, especially like if I've been around large groups of people and I'm a little more likely, or travel, I'm a little more likely to kind of pick something up, or for my immune system to take a hit. I've always kind of been a fan of the honey and vinegar blend anyhow. I've played around with it with sassafras leaf. I've done it with the Rose of Sharon. I've done it with mimosa flower. It's, like I said, this is something that you could do year round. And they're just not very common. I'm not real sure if it's just kind of not really in the public consciousness. One friend told me that she did it with magnolia flowers. I just thought that was really cool. So that's a little one-on-one on Oxymels. If you guys try it, let me know how it goes. Give me a shout over at strongrootsresources.com. And lastly, our next foraging class here on the farm in Knoxville, Tennessee is going to be on July 12th. So holler at me if you are in the area and you would like to come out to that. We'll have a great walk on the farm, finding and chatting about all the useful edible and medicinal plants that are hanging out here. Thank you all for listening, and we will talk to you next time.
I think that's a very cool thing. And again, I've got a really long back history with herbs and herbal medicines, going all the way back to things I learned from my grandfather when I had a single digit in my age. I actually took a significant amount of coursework on herbs as well, and I've read every book I can get my hands on. I have never heard of this, and it makes perfect sense. It's basically like a tincture light, and it has other uses. It's pretty cool. So now you know. Let's hear now about the difference between Bitcoin Core and Bitcoin Knots. Is it a new Bitcoin? Does it matter? Anything going to happen out of it? From Jesse Markowitz.
Hi, this is Jesse Markowitz at yourpersonalbitcoinassistant.com. Today's question comes from Rachel, who asks, I've heard there's some controversy about Bitcoin Core and something called Knots. Is Knots a different Bitcoin? What's the real difference between the two, and why does it matter? Bitcoin is open source software. As open source software, it's possible for anyone to copy the code and create an alternate implementation. Some alternatives change the rules in incompatible ways, creating a hard fork and new coins like Bitcoin Cash. Some are just alternate implementations that remain compatible with the Bitcoin network. So, what are Bitcoin Core and Bitcoin Knots? Bitcoin Core is the software originally developed by Satoshi Nakamoto and released in 2009. Development on it has continued over the years by a number of developers. It is the original and most widely used Bitcoin node software. Bitcoin Knots is an alternative version of Bitcoin that is compatible with Bitcoin Core. It was started by a developer named Luke Dash Jr. Knots started as a copy, a fork of Core, but adds features and gives more control to users over how their node works. Both programs run the Bitcoin protocol and are fully compatible with each other. If you run a Bitcoin node, you can choose either one. Your node will still be part of the Bitcoin network. The basis of the recent controversy is over what should be stored on Bitcoin and how things that shouldn't be stored there can be prevented or discouraged from being stored. Bitcoin's original vision was that a purely peer-to-peer version of electronic cash would allow online payments to be sent directly from one party to another without going through a financial institution. Because Bitcoin's blockchain offers some very unique properties, immutability, public validation, and decentralization, it can be very attractive for storing other arbitrary information. Some data is fairly non-controversial. Things like hashes of documents or files, they can provide proof of existence without tampering and consume very small amounts of space. One dramatic example of this were the Guatemalan elections. There's a great documentary. It's about 16 minutes long about how Bitcoin saved Guatemalan elections. You can see that at film.simpleproof.com. Other data can be more controversial. Storing large images, audio, and NFTs directly on-chain increases the blockchain size and increases the load placed on those who run Bitcoin nodes. Also, because users are charged for storage in the blocks, the more people competing for storage space, particularly folks putting large amounts of storage on the blockchain, can drive up the cost of transactions within Bitcoin. But is that data spam that actually harms the network? Some people think so. The argument is that storing large data on the Bitcoin blockchain isn't using it for its original purpose, which is electronic cash. And since this spam takes up more room on the blockchain, making it more expensive to run a node, which could result in fewer people running nodes and Bitcoin becoming more centralized. Others believe it's not up to them to decide if it's spam or not, but that folks trying to censor data going into Bitcoin is worse than the damage that any spam would do. And since everyone pays for their data to be placed into the Bitcoin blockchain via transaction fees, there should not be any discrimination based on the type of data. Finally, there are those who argue it's not spam. The more people using Bitcoin, the better. The more use cases for using Bitcoin, the better. That this is actually a positive for adoption of Bitcoin, that more people use it in more ways. Now, changing the consensus rules about what transactions and what arbitrary data are allowed to be added into the blocks is very challenging. If there's not overwhelming consensus, the result of different software running different consensus rules could be a contentious hard fork chain split, resulting in a new coin. So instead, the software developers are making changes to the node software to the relay rules about what transactions will be accepted by a node to be relayed to other nodes. If only a small percentage of nodes are willing to relay your transaction, you may find it more difficult to get your transaction into a block. You may not be able to get it in at all, or you may need to negotiate directly with a miner to have that transaction added in. Bitcoin Core made a change recently to increase the op return limit from 80 bytes to nearly 4 megabytes, dramatically increasing that size to allow that larger data to be embedded within a single op return output. The reasoning is this. Users are going to put arbitrary data into the system anyway. Putting it into op return is a more efficient and less harmful way of doing it than other methods of storing data within the transactions. Therefore, encouraging people who are going to put arbitrary data into it anyway to do so in a more efficient manner would be better for the overall network. Note, this is a change to the default settings in Bitcoin Core software. Users running Bitcoin Core do not have to run with this particular setting. They could have op return changed back to its original setting if desired. Bitcoin Knots provides options to not relay transactions that meet certain spam criteria. For example, one of those options is to reduce the allowed size for op return data from the previous Core default of 80 to as low as 35. In addition, there are settings that prevent non-standard transactions and non-standard outputs from being relayed. Finally, Knots also allows you to adjust the dust threshold, making it harder for large numbers of low-value outputs to be used. From a practical standpoint, unless an overwhelming percentage of nodes are running relay settings to block this arbitrary data, users desiring to get their arbitrary data into the blockchain will still be able to do so. Knotts believes that at the margin, making it more difficult will discourage and reduce the amount of spam. Four believes that making it easier to store arbitrary data in an op return will reduce the harm from the amount of arbitrary data stored. At the end of the day, I'm happy to see a solid competitor to Bitcoin Core. I want to see more Bitcoiners running their own nodes of whatever flavor. Even if you have your own keys and self-custody your Bitcoin, if you are using someone else's Bitcoin node, you are dependent on them. Running a Bitcoin node for yourself allows you to check your balances, validate and send transactions privately and securely. Choosing to run Bitcoin Core versus Knotts is up to you. Core has a larger group of developers and a focus on stability. Knotts has more options for spam data filtering and a focus on greater customization and user controls. If you happen to be using a Start OS server, you can select either. They're equally easy to install. If you haven't yet started your Bitcoin journey, it's not too late. Jack has great resources at thebitcoinbreakout.com. And if you want more personal assistance starting or going deeper down the rabbit hole, feel free to contact me and we'll see how I can help you. This has been Jesse Markowitz of yourpersonalbitcoinassistant.com. I look forward to more technology questions. Send them in to Jack and I will get them answered.
So the reason I haven't bothered to talk about this much, I completely get all of the debate. I do think that it's worth at least talking about whether we get rid of stupid JPEG inscriptions in the blocks. I think there's more than one solution to it, but I don't think Knotts is a solution to anything. I think Core is Core is Core. The vast majority of nodes are still running some version of Core. The Knotts people have tried to hype up what percentage they are versus like the latest version of Core. But the thing is, there's a shitload of people that are running prior versions of Core. It's all backwards compatible. And when you look at it that way, Knotts is a tiny, infinitesimally small component of the things. And the biggest thing with Bitcoin is to actually change something. You have to gain consensus in three ways. You have to gain consensus of the node operators. You have to gain consensus of the miners, and you have to gain consensus of the market. Even if the node operators manage to get up to, say, 51%, which they're not gonna, but if they did, it still wouldn't actually change anything. The inscriptions would still be there. They would still be on the blockchains. The fees would still be part of the equation. And by the way, fees are lower right now than they've been for a very, 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 very long time. I also feel that Knotts is now trying to solve a problem that doesn't exist. And as more and more of the financial transactions move onto the Lightning Network and probably other layers in the future, this will become even less important. I envision a future where you probably won't see on-chain transactions under about $5,000 in today's money. So as you go forward in the future, inflation adjusts that. There'll be a day when they'll be generally $10,000 and up. This is something Michael Saylor recently talked about in one of his speeches at one of the Bitcoin conferences, the concept of cash settlement. And when people say cash settlement, they always think like the early days of Bitcoin. I send you Bitcoin, you have it as cash settlement. But the word cash settlement in finance and economics does not historically mean that. In Saylor's talk, he talked about how the Rothschilds were experts at trading sovereign debt. And when they used the term cash settlement, they meant gold in the form of coin or bullion. And so for every, you know, thousands upon thousands of these sovereign debt exchanges, even under the gold standard, no gold moved. Only the final settlement was in gold. And so for every gold final settlement, there was maybe 10,000 transactions. Bitcoin, when people say it's digital gold, the problem that people take with that is they think they mean the way gold works today. That's not what it means. It means the way gold worked in a gold standard. It was a settlement layer. It was the network that the transactions wrote on top of in a layer even back at the time. If you want to know more about it, just look it up or ask your favorite AI unit to explain it to you and see if they get it right. I would challenge that one. I'm not sure AI would get that one right at all. It might really struggle. Let's move on now to the underappreciated peppercorn with Chef Ken Daniels.
Hello all, Chef Ken here. Today's question comes from Dudley. He asks, I love black pepper. Are there any other peppercorns that I don't know about? That's a terrific question, Dudley, and I appreciate it because pepper is one of those ingredients we use every day without really thinking about it. It's there on nearly every table. We twist a grinder over almost every dish. But how often do we actually stop and ask, what is this, and what else is out there? So today, let's break this wide open. Black pepper comes from the dried berry of a vine, harvested while the berries are still green and unripe, then dried until they wrinkle and turn black. That drying process is what gives black pepper its signature pungency, that sharp, bright aroma and taste we all recognize. But what most people don't realize is that this same plant can give us different peppercorns just depending on how it's processed after picking. There's black pepper, of course. Bold, woody, punchy, exactly what you expect. Then there's white pepper. It's made from the same berries, but they're left to ripen fully on the vine, and then the outer skin is removed, leaving just the pale seed. The result, white pepper is earthier, a little milder, a little funkier, common in Chinese cuisine or in pale sauces where you don't want black flecks to show up. You've also got green peppercorns, picked while unripe and either dried quickly or preserved in brine to keep that fresh, herbal quality. The flavor is brighter, milder, a totally different character. And then, red peppercorns. These are fully ripened berries that have retained a reddish tint and a subtle fruitiness. They're rare, but worth trying if you can find them. Now, everything I've mentioned so far comes from the same plant, just handled differently. But there's a whole other category of ingredients that get called peppercorn, even though they're not related at all. For example, pink peppercorns. These delicate, rosy berries look beautiful in a mix, but they're not true pepper. The flavor is mild, floral, a little fruity, not nearly as pungent as black pepper. They're great in salads, seafood dishes, or even as a garnish, but they come with a warning. They're related to cashews and can trigger nut allergies. Then we have Sichuan peppercorns. Again, not a true pepper. They're famous for delivering that numbing, tingling sensation that makes Sichuan cuisine so distinct. It's not heat, it's that curious buzz you feel on your lips and tongue. The flavor is bright, citrusy, almost electric. Toast them, grind them, and they add incredible energy to a dish. And last, long pepper. This is an ancient spice, a true cousin of black pepper, but visually very different. Instead of round berries, long pepper grows in slender, spiky cones. The flavor is hotter, deeper, muskier, and it lingers longer. Long pepper was actually prized before black pepper dominated global trade. So yes, Dudley, there's a whole world beyond the familiar black pepper. Each of these varieties brings something different to the table, whether it's heat, aroma, brightness, or nuance. But here's the key point, and it's a big one. Knowing about these varieties doesn't matter much if your pepper itself isn't good. The difference between fresh, high-quality peppercorns and the dusty stuff sitting in a supermarket aisle is night and day. Before you chase rare and exotic peppercorns, you need to understand what makes even basic black pepper worth using. It's about quality, freshness, and intention. So next, let's talk about exactly how to recognize, source, and store good pepper, because that alone will change how your food tastes. Because pepper is everywhere, it's easy to assume it doesn't really matter which one you use. But here's the thing, most of what's sold as black pepper in grocery stores isn't worth your time or money. Pre-ground pepper, it's stale. The volatile oils that give pepper its aroma and heat evaporate fast after grinding. By the time that pre-ground powder reaches your kitchen, most of its life is gone. Even whole peppercorns can be poor quality if they've been sitting in a warehouse for a year or more. They lose that sharpness, that aroma that makes pepper exciting. So simply having whole peppercorns isn't enough. You have to think about how they're sourced and stored. First step, always buy whole peppercorns. Grind them fresh every time. That alone makes a huge difference. Next, source them from a spice merchant or a supplier who focuses on freshness and quality, not a faceless big brand. Look for origins like Telecherry or Malabar. These aren't marketing gimmicks. They indicate real differences in flavor and quality. Telecherry peppercorns, for example, are larger, more mature berries with a richer, more complex aroma. Malabar peppercorns are a bit less bold, but still excellent when fresh. When you're inspecting peppercorns, look for plumpness. They should feel heavy for their size, uniform, and show a slight oily sheen. If they look shriveled, dusty, or dry, leave them behind. Once you've sourced good pepper, treat it right. Store it in an airtight container away from heat, light, and moisture. That little spice rack next to the stove, worst place you could keep it. Heat will kill those delicate oils fast. And these same rules apply whether you're buying classic black pepper or exploring pink peppercorns, Sichuan, long pepper, or anything else. Freshness matters more than novelty. The truth is, even a properly sourced, well-stored black peppercorn can outperform an expensive, exotic blend if that blend blend isn't fresh. So before you go expanding your collection, master the basics. Make sure the black pepper you're using today is excellent, because that's the foundation. Now, once you have that foundation, everything else becomes a tool you can reach for with purpose. Pink peppercorns when you want floral lift, long pepper when you want deep, warm musk, white pepper when you want subtlety without visible specks, green pepper when you want something fresh and herbal. But no matter what you choose, it starts with respect for the ingredient itself. Pepper isn't just a seasoning, it's shaped human histories. And today, it still shapes the flavor of what's on your plate. So next time you reach for your pepper grinder, think about what you're holding, where it came from, how fresh it is, and what you want it to say in your dish. Dudley, I hope this helps. Keep sending those questions coming in. You can find me at bloodsugarchef.com and drinkeatlearn.com. Until next time, this is Ken, the Blood Sugar Chef.
I mean, pepper really is underrated. There's entire, like, cacio e pepe. Cacio e pepe is an Italian pasta dish that, I mean, pepper is the whole thing. But there's a lot of cuisine in the world that relies on different peppercorns. And it is a fantastic seasoning spice. Call it what you want to. I want to drill down on two of the peppers he mentioned. One is long pepper. It's available on Amazon. I've never featured it on T-Spaz, and I probably should. Long pepper has little tiny peppercorns, and they almost look like a, kind of like a pine cone, but all the same diameter. A little tiny pine cone, or like a catkin off of a certain tree. And they are much hotter than your typical black pepper. And if I learned about them from J.A. Townsend and Sons, which I love their YouTube channel, all their cooking stuff. If you read a recipe from like around the time of the colonies and the first settlement or first days of the Republic under, you know, the 1700s, early 1800s, if you read a recipe from that time and it calls for pepper, it was probably long pepper. It was actually considered to be superior at that time to what we think of as pepper today. Then it kind of just got faded out as it became less expensive to produce the pepper that we have today. And all of a sudden it wasn't superior anymore when the other stuff was cheaper. So yeah, some frugality in that, I guess. But it's an awesome, awesome spice. And then pink peppercorns, you don't usually think pepper and dessert. But pink peppercorn can work on the savory or the sweet side. It is from a tree, and I do have that on T-Spaz. I added in the show notes today my favorite brand of pink peppercorns. These things, it's weird. They do have that background flavor that it's not just spicy. It tastes like pepper. It has that smell and that feel that black pepper has. Yet, it's a totally different thing, and they're actually very soft, and you can literally pop them into your mouth and eat them like popcorn. Ask me how I know. Anyway, let's now hear from Doc Bones. We ain't heard from him in a couple of weeks on risks and mitigation of hailstorms.
Hi, Joe MD here, also known as Dr. Bones of the survival website doomandbloom.net, co-author of the Book Excellence Award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook, and designer of quality medical kits at store.doomandbloom.net. Recently, the upper Midwest was victim to a number of storms which produced hail. Hail can be a dangerous threat, and you should know a little bit about it. Hail no, you say? Well, I say hail yes. In the event I just mentioned, a rain-laden, low-pressure system pulled in moisture from the high plains and northern Rockies into the Dakotas, bringing with it severe thunderstorms carrying hail and high winds, causing damage to structures and crops. So what is hail, actually? Hail is a type of solid precipitation. It shouldn't be confused with sleet, which are smaller pellets which generally fall in cold weather. Hail consists of irregular lumps of ice called hailstones. Hailstones usually measure between 5 millimeters, 0.2 inches, and 15 centimeters, 6 inches in size, and can weigh as much as a pound. Although they can occur in winter, they're not as closely related to it as sleet. Hail can be seen in just about any thunderstorm. In the mid-latitudes, hail forms in the interior, while in the tropics, it tends to be confined to places of high elevation. A thunderstorm which produces hail is known as a hailstorm. Unlike sleet, hail is made up mostly of transparent ice which is formed as it travels through the clouds, remaining suspended aloft for up to 30 minutes by air updrafts until its weight causes it to fall to the ground miles below. The more intense the updraft, the larger the hail. Now, it should be noted that conditions that produce hail are also very favorable for the formation of tornadoes. Like other precipitation, hail begins as water droplets. As the droplets rise and the temperature goes below freezing, they become supercooled water and freeze. A cross-section through a large hailstone shows basically what looks like an onion-like structure, as peels and layers. This means that the hailstone is made of thick and translucent layers alternating with ones that are thin, white, and opaque. Classic theory suggested that hailstones were subjected to multiple ups and downs, falling into a zone of humidity and refreezing as they were lifted by updrafts. This theory is not accepted by everybody, however. Generally speaking, larger hailstones will form some distance from the stronger updrafts, where they can take their time growing. As the hailstone grows, its exterior stays in a liquid phase, keeping it sticky and allowing further growth by collision with other hailstones. Hail can also undergo dry growth, in which the exterior is not in a liquid state. Hail forming in this manner appears opaque due to tiny air bubbles that become trapped in the stone during rapid freezing. These bubbles can and do escape, making this type of hailstone somewhat clearer in appearance. Hail formation is more likely when the freezing level is below 11,000 feet, usually in interior areas of mid-latitude landmasses. Movement of dry air into strong thunderstorms can increase the frequency of hail by promoting cooling, giving hail a larger area to grow in. Hail is less common in the tropics, despite a much higher frequency of thunderstorms than in the mid-latitudes. This is because the atmosphere tends to be warmer at a much greater altitude. It's not impossible, however, hail in the tropics can occur at the higher elevations. This year, scientists in the United States became engaged in a project studying hail processes in thunderstorms in what we call Hail Alley. This area encompasses the Great Plains and Colorado and Wyoming's front range of the Rocky Mountains. Hail season is most active from May to September, and this year's hail hunters may help us prevent some of the damage with their research. Now, as an aside, Canada has its own hail alley in South and Central Alberta. How does hail cause damage besides bonking you on the head? Hailstones greater than about 2 centimeters, that's about 3/4 inch or so, they're considered large enough to cause damage to agriculture. Wheat, corn, soybeans, and tobacco are the most vulnerable crops, especially early in the season. Damage is proportional to the velocity of falling hail. Speed varies by size and other factors. It's thought that a 1 centimeter hailstone falls at a rate of about 20 miles per hour, while larger stones the size of, let's say, 3 inches in diameter can fall at a rate of 110 miles per hour. Now, that's dependent on the size of the stone, its drag coefficient, the motion of wind that's falling through, collisions with raindrops or other hailstones, and melting as the stones fall through a warmer atmosphere. It should be admitted, however, that since hailstones are not perfect spheres, well, it's not that easy to accurately calculate their speed. Hail can cause serious damage, mostly to crops, as I mentioned, but also to aircraft, automobiles, glass roof structures, and livestock. Regular roof damage is also pretty common, but often goes unnoticed until leaks and cracks in the ceiling are identified. That could happen months later. Metal roofs are fairly resistant, but cosmetic deformities such as dents, well, they're pretty commonly seen. In 2023, hailstones cost the United States $46 billion in damage to cars, roofs, and crops. When hailstones exceed 1/2 inch in size, it can also present a hazard to landing aircraft. Hail is a common nuisance to car owners in Hail Alley, denting them and, of course, cracking or even shattering windshields and windows unless covered in some way. Now, how likely is harm to humans? Although rare in the modern era, large hailstones have been known to cause serious or even fatal head trauma to people caught outside without shelter. On April 30, 1888, a severe hailstone killed more than 200 people in the Moradabad district of India. In the United States, however, only 3 people are on record ever to be killed by falling hail. Hailstones usually last from a few minutes up to 15 minutes in duration, but they can cause severe damage to infrastructure during that time. Accumulating hail may blanket the ground, causing loss of power, bring down trees. Flash flooding due to blocked drains and mudslides within areas of steep terrain can also occur. On rare occasions, a thunderstorm can become nearly stationary while producing hail and cause significant accumulation. As a matter of fact, on July 29, 2010, a foot of hail accumulated in Boulder County, Colorado. On June 5, 2015, hail up to 4 feet deep fell on one city block in Denver, Colorado. You Coloradans, if this is true, I'd like to know about it. The National Weather Service often refers to hailstones based on their similarity to everyday objects. For example, a 0.25 inch hailstone would be pea-sized, 0.75 inch penny-sized, 1 inch quarter-sized. Golf ball-sized hail, everybody's heard about, 1.75 inches, And baseball size hail, well, that's at least 2.75 inches. Records exist for the heaviest hail and largest. 1 kilogram in Bangladesh, that's 2.2 pounds, that's in 1986, and 20 centimeters in diameter, 8 inches in South Dakota in 2010. So let's talk about hail safety. That's really what's important. In the event you find yourself caught in a hailstorm, if you're caught outside, seek shelter immediately. If you can't get under some kind of cover, find something to protect your head. Seeking shelter under trees, however, that's a last resort. Hail can bring down large branches right down on top of you. If you're in a building, stay inside, stay away from the windows until the hail stops. If you're in an automobile, get under a highway underpass or other cover. Pull completely off the road. Do not leave the vehicle. Windshields can shatter, so get face down with your back to the glass. Prepare your home for a hailstorm. Let's assume your roof is in good shape. If it's a flat roof, it's at most risk for damage. Fiber cement is thought to be superior to vinyl or aluminum siding. It's pretty resilient against hail. It's also very important to protect windows, doors, and skylights. Close your drapes and blinds to form a barrier against possibly broken glass. Of course, in Hail Alley, storm shutters are a great investment and also help protect against high wind conditions. Consider an upgrade to impact-resistant windows. Bring all your furniture inside, your barbecues, your potted plants. If you can't bring them inside, put them under sturdy cover. That's very, very important. For larger items that can't be moved, cover with a tarp or other kind of protective barrier. This is Joe Alton, MD, that old Dr. Bones, wishing you the best of health in good times or bad. Thanks for listening. Hey, learn more about more than 200 off-grid medical topics in the award-winning fourth edition of the Survival Medicine Handbook. And get your family medically prepared with quality kits and individual supplies from our entire line at store.doomandbloom.net. You'll be glad you did.
Good segment from Doc, and I'll tell you, hail can be dangerous and deadly so. Back in 2000, in fact, it was March 28, the year 2000, long before any of y'all knew who Jack Spirko was. I mean, a few of you out there did, but very few people listening to this show knew who Jack Spirko was in the year 2000. We had a tornado that the storm itself split into two cells. One went to the south and one went straight east, and it spawned two tornadoes. And the larger of the two tornadoes hit downtown Fort Worth and destroyed the Bank One building. And the one that broke off to the southeast destroyed homes less than a mile from my house. My wife literally drove around it without knowing that's what she was doing. She was at the gym working out, and when she saw the storm coming, she decided to drive home. And it was literally like it went catty corner from one intersection to the other as she drove around it. And fortunately, nothing happened to her. This was one of the worst tornadoes to hit the Dallas-Fort Worth area in recorded history. This was bad. And it continued to touch down and skip across things. I had a client called Aetna, a healthcare company at the time, that was building a facility only about 5 miles from my house, and that facility was about 80% finished with construction, and they elected to not even rebuild it because it was so badly damaged. It blew down signs, like the big-ass signs going across four-lane highways. It just so happened that nobody was killed. There was only one person fatally injured in that entire storm, and nobody else was even super, as bad as it looked, nobody was even superficially injured except the one gentleman who was killed. He was killed in an area known as Redbird, to the east of Grand Prairie, Texas. He was hit in the head with a hailstone the size of a softball. So, as Bone says, do you need to know about hail? Hell yes. All right, so let's talk about my subject today. And mine's going to be short because this episode went kind of long, and I kind of picked this one out to keep it short. But a gentleman reached out to me, and we've been actually trading some stuff back and forth. I've been a little bit of a butt to him, I think, about it's mycology speak. The guys from here's my thing with this, right? Just for Tyler listening in, probably because he's on the show today. When you talk to a mycologist, it's like talking to a supercomputer nerd and add biology to it. They start telling you things that if you knew what the hell they were saying, you wouldn't be asking the question, right? Like, it's like talking to the Big Bang Theory guys or something about some deep computer issue. And like, well, all you do is do this, this, and if I knew what any of those words meant, I wouldn't be asking you the question. And I'm not picking on them, just, you know, they love what they do and they get really good at it. But Tyler also reached out about my suggestion to bury sawdust blocks. And here's what he said. I'm just going to read his email. He said, What results from the cool breakdown, not hot compost of blocks, I think, is a slightly acidic, humic acid-rich, fungal-dominant soil. I agree with him 100% on that. You're now my language. I understand what you're saying here. In my limited experience, this is great for nightshades and many perennials. It's great for everything, but you're right. The nightshades particularly like these fungal-rich garden soils. He says, I use spent blocks to turn lawn into gardens. Smashing spent blocks and covering with wood chips works great as a sheet mulch. I put mushroom trim and spent blocks on the top of a terminated cover crop. I use them on the edges of rows. I make paths out of them. I place intact mushroom blocks around the garden to create zones where worms tunnel back and forth through the soil levels. I also add blocks to hot compost. I plan to create side business producing Taylor, Johnson, Sioux, and vermicompost. But in the meantime, I'm in Philly. I'm generating 11-pound blocks a day. 80 blocks a day. That's more than a man can use, folks, okay? And I'd be happy to pass off spent blocks to any other TSP members who want to come pick them up. If you want to email him, he gives out his email address. I'm going to put it in the show notes because you're not going to spell it right. So just go by the show notes for today's episode to get his email address and look under my segment and I'll put his email address there. For most species, we're one flush and done. So blocks have a lot of energy in them. Oysters and enoki especially will give you more mushrooms, weather depending, but also pia pepino, shiitake, coral tooth, lion's mane. I feel like I'm leaving some stuff out, but I'll leave it there for now. Thank you for putting out such great stuff all these years, Tyler. Well, Tyler, thanks for offering to help other people. So I'm going to say, with that quantity, there might even be some people that aren't right in the Philadelphia area that might kind of pool together and send somebody out there, like, can you save them up for a week with a trailer or a big truck or something? And just, I mean, you could have all kinds of fun, couldn't you? And I like everything Tyler's doing with this stuff. Here's my advice on the bioreactor compost utilizing these blocks. Build your bioreactor, and if you include that, you include that. It's fine. Just go ahead. But when you apply the moisture and you apply, you're going to need, you know, nitrogen added to this. There's low nitrogen in mushroom production, very low. So you're going to have to bring in manure or green clippings or something like that as a nitrogen load. There's a very intense thermophilic cycle that occurs in a bioreactor that will run anywhere between 5 and 20 days with core temperatures reaching up into the range anywhere between 120, which is going to kill most fungi, okay, up to about 165, which is pretty much going to kill all fungi that I know of. It will not kill all of it because you don't turn it, and this is part of why the fungus in bioreactor compost is able to colonize so quickly after the thermocycle goes down. It's even doing it before it fully declines. Your outer edges never get that hot. If you take your compost thermometer in a newly constructed bioreactor, say 2-3 days in, and you push it down in the center, you're going to find 130, 140, 145, 150 degrees, maybe higher, depending on how much nitrogen you have and what the body of it is. But if you take that compost thermometer and you put it, you know, 12 inches deep, but 2 inches from the outer edge, it's barely going to show much thermal activity at all. And because of that, there's pockets where the fungi survive. I would still take this approach. Once the thermal cycle is over, pull back and bury more blocks in it. In fact, I'm not going to do any more of what I've been doing, which is I will add mushrooms to my bioreactors by soaking wood chips in a wheelbarrow and mixing in a couple blocks of spawn and then capping it with that, because I get very poor to no mushroom flush, and it's not just because of my climate. Here's what's happening. With that mycelium spread out like that, and that thermal cycle ends and the worms come, the worms eat the shit out of that mycelium. Worms eat mycelium. I'm telling you, they do. That's why they're going back and forth when he's doing what he's doing with gardens. That's one issue. Now, this is not happening in my bioreactors, but I found this really interesting. I've been reading one of Paul Stamets' books, and He was talking about this mushroom patch that he set up with Kingstrophoria, just like we talked about on the show before. Inoculated wood chip patch, right? Path of the garden, that type of thing. All of a sudden, there's bees everywhere. And the bees are literally moving wood chips to get into the mycelial mat, and they're harvesting the mycelium. The bees were harvesting, and he got no mushrooms out of that. This is the greatest mushroom grower in the world, taken out by bees. So we are not the only people that partake of mushrooms, and you know we think of the fruiting body, but some of these other critters, like worms, go right at the mycelium. Now, if there's enough for everybody, you still get fruiting. But if you put that whole block in there, you're really likely to get some fruiting, and you're also going to get kind of these different pockets and spaces, which I think are very beneficial in a bioreactor. And again, I am fully on board at this point with just burying blocks in your gardens. I think it's a fan. And all the other stuff Tyler said, so if you're in the Philly area, or like you're on the Telegram group or something like that, and you're like, you know, even 150 miles away, if you've got some other TSPers, like you get shit done crews together and stuff, this is a resource, and you'd be helping him, because as much as he's doing with it, that's more than most people. That's a waste stream that he can't completely deal with himself. So I recommend that we, and then my other recommendation, there's probably someone near you like Tyler. Some of you right now go, damn, I wish I was near Philadelphia, even though 100 miles away, man. It's a day trip. I go out there and see his mushroom farm and load up a pickup truck with about 200 blocks of that shit and take it home, and I just start putting it everywhere. But I wish I can't do it because I'm 800 miles away. Check. This is common. There are many mushroom farms that are happy to give away spent blocks. And like he said, most farms, they're one and done. And it's not because that block doesn't have energy, it's not because it's not going to produce again, but as a commercial producer, you're in it for profit. And they're not buying blocks for $28 from a store like we do. They have giant equipment. They're sterilizing 100 blocks or so in one go. They're using liquid culture injections. They're producing these blocks for $3 to $6 a block instead of $20 to $30 a block. And then that means that they will just make more money by this thing flushed. I'm going to harvest the mushrooms. Out the door they go. They go to market, and I put another block in and start the and just keep it running. They're making, moving, fruiting, and discarding blocks like a conveyor belt every day. And, I mean, they are all over the place. This is becoming really big, and it's only going to get bigger. I think this is one of the true growth industries. If you're a young person and you don't want to go to college, but you kind of like science and you kind of like agriculture, man, all the information is basically open source. It might be a book you have to buy, but what I'm saying is nothing's hidden. Nothing's hidden. Mycologists, to me, amateur and professional both, I know I sound like I was picking on them at the beginning. It's just because they love what they do. That's just, we nerd out. I guarantee you there's people, if they listen to me and my buddy David talk about aquaponics, they feel the same way. They're like, what the hell are these guys saying? What the hell are... Or listen to me and J.R. Haley talk about guns. Even a guy that likes guns, I don't know what the hell they're talking about, right? We all get like that, so I'm not picking on them. But they are the most open people in the world. They remind me of beekeepers. In that, if you tell a beekeeper you're thinking about keeping bees, you're fixing to get an education on beekeeping. It'll go 2 hours if you don't stop them. And that's a wonderful thing. And that means if you're looking for something you can sink your teeth into and make a real difference in the world, this is a great place to go. I honestly think this girl should fill out a guest form and get on the show. Somebody on Facebook told me that their daughter, young daughter, teenager, Lamner, Flow Hood, liquid cultures, the whole deal, she's into this full bore. That could be you or someone you know. So hook up with these folks, learn, participate, etc., at whatever level you want to. But if you just want blocks, just check and see, is there anybody farming mushrooms, you know, within an hour's drive or less of where you live, and then contact them and say, hey, would you be interested in offloading some of your spent blocks? And they may have somebody buying them from them or something, but I mean, honest to God, even that, I bet you it's cheap. I bet you they would do it. I haven't met many people in many industries that are more approachable than people in this space. Again, sometimes they come off a little weird. But the more I learn, the more I understand that. They're speaking a different language. They're understanding a third kingdom. Most of us grow up, we become very familiar with the kingdom of animals and plants. This is a completely different world, and it's really, really fascinating and interesting. Anyway, with that, I've wrapped everything up. I did my product segment at the beginning of the show today, so I won't rehash it much other than to say if you want to help us out, do your online shopping at tspaz.com. I'm telling you, Streaming Wars is worth the read. I'm not saying it just because it's an old friend that wrote the book. It really is an awesome book. It's an amazing history, and consider joining the MSB, because if you do that, you support us in the best way possible, and you get your money back. Like I said, even if you hate me, if you don't join the MSB, you hate money even more. Take care, guys. I'll catch you next week with a whole new round of episodes. Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way. Let me show you a better way.